This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 2nd, 2008. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, community groups in El Salvador want an investigation into the murder of one of the Suchitoto 14. Another Pakistani reporter is killed, making the country one of the most dangerous spots in the world for journalists. And with the final round of states voting tomorrow, the end is near, maybe, in the Democratic presidential primary. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A suicide bomber blew up a car outside the Danish embassy in Islamabad today, killing 10 people and wounding nearly 30 others. Mudassir Shah has more from Islamabad.
According to Interior Ministry sources, a foreign national is also among the dead. A joint team of police, federal investigation agents, and security agencies was established to investigate the blast. The UN project office was also destroyed. Some media reports in Pakistan suggest that the blast may have been an assassination attempt on the life of President Pervez Musharraf. Denmark had downgraded the embassy and moved out most foreign staff in recent months. They took this action due to threats linked to the reproduction in February of what most Muslims believe were sick religious cartoons in Danish media. Denmark is now advising its citizens against all travels to Pakistan. Before today's blast, they merely cautioned against unnecessary trips to the country. Norway has temporarily closed its embassy in Islamabad after today's violence. Foreign Secretary Salman Bashir, speaking at the scene, offered assurances that the government will do everything to protect diplomatic missions and ensure the security and safety of citizens of Pakistan. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mudassir Shah in Islamabad.
A judge today ordered more than 460 children be returned to their parents after they were removed from a ranch in Texas during a raid in early April. Today's ruling allowed the parents to begin picking their children up from foster facilities around the state almost immediately. The families are members of the Fundamentalist Church of Latter-day Saints who practice polygamy. The judge's order requires them to stay in Texas, attend parenting classes, and allow the children to be examined as part of any ongoing child abuse investigation. Skyrocketing oil prices in Chile contribute to slower economic growth and higher inflation. As oil prices continue to climb, truck owners have called for a national strike tomorrow. From Santiago, Free Speech Radio News' Jorge Garatón has more.
The strike call for Tuesday is in response to the high diesel prices paid by truckers to gas their rigs. But a major truckers association jumped the gun today and has partially shut down parts of the main highway that links the capital, Santiago, with the main port in central Chile. The truckers are demanding the government do something about the high price of diesel. They demand the government remove the specific diesel tax and that highway toll prices be frozen. In response, the government announced today a $1 billion investment into an oil price stabilization fund aimed at reducing the fuel price paid at the pumps. The government told truckers to sit down and talk instead of striking. But truckers who pay on average $4.70 for the gallon of diesel say the measure is not enough because it will only reduce the price of diesel some 35 cents per gallon. Truckers say the strike is on beginning at midnight tonight. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
According to the UN Human Rights Council, thousands of killings by Brazilian police are going largely unpunished because of public approval for a perceived crackdown on crime. UN Special Envoy Philip Alston presented his findings today to a Human Rights Council meeting in Geneva. He says officials have often turned a blind eye to extrajudicial executions by police in crime-riddled Rio de Janeiro state because of what he calls policing by opinion poll. Bolivians voted overwhelmingly Sunday for autonomy measures in two opposition-controlled states, where the polling was accompanied by confrontations, roadblocks, and the burning of ballot boxes. Free Speech Radio News' Diletta Varlese reports.
It was a tense day in the Beni and Pando regions. In the northern Amazonian areas of Bolivia, 69% of voters cast ballots in Beni, more than 80% of those supporting autonomy. In Pando, while the measure also passed by a wide margin, 50% of voters stayed away from the polls. In all, four provinces from the eastern lowland region are resisting land and resource redistribution measures pushed by President Evo Morales. These reforms would benefit the poorer, mostly indigenous Bolivians of the mountainous western regions. Government officials call the regional referendum illegal, and President Evo Morales says that he is not afraid to face the national vote of confidence scheduled for mid-August. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Diletta Varlese.
Senator Edward Kennedy is out of surgery at Duke University. His doctor says the procedure to treat his cancerous brain tumor was successful. Kennedy was awake during the 3.5-hour procedure. The 76-year-old senator now faces chemotherapy and radiation. Senator Kennedy should experience no permanent neurological effects from the surgery. A Kennedy spokesperson says the senator told his wife just after the surgery that he felt like $1 million. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The final days of the Democratic primary race have been just as eventful as the first ones. The Democratic Rules Committee reinstated half of Michigan and Florida's delegates, and Senator Hillary Clinton continues to have a strong showing in some states and territories. She received an easy win in Puerto Rico on Sunday. Senator Barack Obama continues to shore up support from superdelegates, inching him closer to securing the nomination. And although signs showed Senator Clinton is winding down her campaign, she continues to publicly vie for the nomination. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, Senator Clinton's focus continues to be on popular vote, which is where she claims to have the majority, an argument adopted by many of her loyal supporters. But it's an assertion that most accounts dispute.
At her victory speech in Puerto Rico Sunday night, where she won a resounding victory, 68% to Barack Obama's 32%, Senator Clinton highlighted the larger picture.
More people across the country have voted for our campaign. More people have voted for us than for any candidate in the history of presidential primary.
More than any candidate, including rival Senator Obama. The Clinton campaign also released a television ad over the weekend pointing to 17 million Clinton voters.
Some say there isn't a single reason for Hillary Clinton to be the Democratic nominee. They're right. There are over 17 million of them.
In recent weeks, Senator Clinton has been focusing on the popular vote, a marker that has no relevance in the Democratic Party as it counts delegates. It's more to make her case to superdelegates. Regardless, many of Senator Clinton's supporters have latched on to the idea, strumming up images of a painful time for Democrats in American politics, the 2000 election, when many believed the election was stolen because Al Gore obtained a majority of the popular vote, but the Supreme Court stopped the Florida count and awarded George Bush the presidency. Here's a Hillary Clinton supporter protesting in Washington over the weekend.
People went out and voted. More voters came out than ever, I understand.
But the difference between this year's presidential primary and the 2000 election is the basis of the argument. Although the vote tallies are extremely close, within a couple hundred thousand votes, Senator Clinton's majority is easily disputed. There's no official count of the popular vote. Media outlets and campaigns keep track, but the Democratic Party does not. As for Senator Clinton's numbers, they do not count the caucus states, many of which Senator Obama won. And regarding Michigan, she gives Senator Obama no votes, since his name was not on the ballot, even though the Democratic Party over the weekend awarded Senator Obama about 35% of Michigan's vote, enough to keep him ahead in the popular vote. Harold Ickes, Clinton campaign strategist, defended their accounting on MSNBC Monday.
238,000 people voted for uncommitted. Some voted for Edwards. So some voted for Edwards, some voted for Biden, some voted for uncommitted.
Meanwhile, Senator Obama continues to rack up additional superdelegates. He's expected to reach the new magic number, 2,118, possibly as soon as tomorrow night, after the last two primaries, South Dakota and Montana, head to the polls. At that point, the contest could be over. But at a Democratic Rules Committee meeting over the weekend, Clinton strategist Ickes said he reserves the right to challenge Michigan's delegate allocation, a process that would extend the primary by another 2 months.
I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that hijacking four delegates, notwithstanding the flawed aspect of this, is not a good way to start down the path of party unity.
Senator Obama seems to be looking forward, though. He will mark the unofficial beginning to the general election with an event Tuesday night in Minneapolis at the same venue that will hold the Republican National Convention. Senator Clinton will spend the end of the primary season with an event Tuesday night in her Senate district, New York City. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Today, the U.S. Senate began debating a bill to reduce carbon emissions in the United States. It is the most significant attempt by Congress to address global warming in a decade, but many lawmakers are skeptical, and so are some environmentalists. FSRN correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
The cap-and-trade bill is sponsored by Republican John Warner and Independent Joseph Lieberman. It calls for greenhouse gas emissions to be brought 18% below 2005 levels by 2020. It then calls for another 70% reduction by 2050. Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch has sponsored investments into renewables in the past, but he opposes the cap-and-trade bill. He says renewables are a better investment.
I think also that we need to do everything we can to develop alternative forms of energy. I passed the CLEAR Act, which helped to develop the hybrid world, the hybrid automobile world, alternative fuels, alternative fuel vehicles, alternative fuel infrastructure.
The cap and trade bill creates an open market for polluters to sell and trade carbon emissions. More than 12 moderate senators have yet to say how they stand on it, including some Democrats. The White House has stopped short of a veto threat, but says the bill would mean an increase in gas prices. Senator Lieberman disagrees.
Oh, some of the arguments are so patently political and unreal. With all respect to the president and some of our opponents, to cite a potential increase in gasoline as a result of this bill just gets it all upside down.
Lieberman says the bill would drive people away from fossil fuels. Many environmental groups support the bill, though some oppose it. Tyson Slocum directs the Energy Program for Public Citizen. He says the bill lets polluters off.
The bill is a huge compromise, and the problem is that its starting point is a compromise. And I don't think that it is aggressive enough in holding big polluters accountable.
Slocum says the bill would create hundreds of billions of dollars in new subsidies for polluters. He says it would be better just to wait till next year.
I don't think that any climate change bill is going to pass this Congress or get signed into law by this president that's going to be effective. I think a better strategy would be to wait until January 2009, when we'll have a new Congress with even larger, environmentally friendly majority in the United States Senate, a new president who will not be so hostile.
Supporters say they are offering the strongest climate change bill that they can right now. They reluctantly admit that even the modest one on the floor may not be able to pass this year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Early last week, Wisconsin became the fifth U.S. state to ratify the Great Lakes Compact, a proposed international agreement between eight states and two Canadian provinces that would protect North America's most important freshwater supply. Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan still have to approve the compact before it goes to the U.S. Congress for ratification. The most recent roadblock is Ohio. Political infighting in the state's legislature is blocking the Natural Resources Protection Deal from passing. WORT's Chris Evans and Molly Stintz have more about the compact.
The Great Lakes Compact allows governors to veto any plan to divert Great Lakes water to other regions of the country unless all of the governors in the region agree. It provides the states an important share in the control of this vital resource. Peter Annan, journalist and author of The Great Lakes Water Wars, explains the significance of this compact.
The fact of the matter is that the Great Lakes region, the North American continent, and the entire world are all entering a period of increased water tension. Those tensions are primarily driven by water scarcity. And one of the largest reservoirs of fresh surface water on Earth is right here in the Great Lakes region. And legal scholars throughout the region and beyond feel that the current legal mechanisms that are set up to protect the waters of the Great Lakes from unwarranted large-scale long-range or short-range diversions has been inadequate.
Some environmentalists warn that global climate change and rising temperatures may threaten the U.S. water supply, causing loss of mountain snowpack to feed lakes and rivers, continued evaporation of reservoirs, and increased demands from the agricultural sector. Others say it has increased demand from arid states with fast-growing populations such as Nevada that are the real threat to the Great Lakes. Nevada Assemblyman Jack Hogan disagrees. He says that while his state is the driest in the country, they have never considered any plan to tap the Great Lakes water.
In several years of involvement in this issue, I had not even heard that mentioned until someone from the Water Authority threw it into the conversation. It was mentioned as, you know, a place where they may have more water than they need, and there might be a way to bring it over. That's probably about all we know about it.
Peter Annan argues that while the cost of transporting water across the country is prohibitive now, this may not always be the case.
You have people saying, yeah, but the economic value of clean, fresh water is skyrocketing, and that it's only a matter of economics, and that sooner or later the scales will tip in the opposite direction. It will actually make economic sense to ship Great Lakes water to far-flung venues.
Once all of the Great Lakes states have passed the compact, it must go to the United States Congress for approval before it can become law. Federal approval is not required in Canada. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Chris Evans with Molly Stentz in Madison, Wisconsin.
In El Salvador, the May 2nd assassination of Hector Antonio Ventura, one of the Suchitoto 14, is still fresh in the minds of citizens. The Suchitoto 14 were taken as political prisoners in July 2007 and cleared of all charges last February. Ventura was stabbed to death while sleeping in a community outside Suchitoto. Now, legal and community organizations are demanding the Salvadoran Attorney General's Office and the National Civilian Police immediately investigate the political connections in Ventura's death. Meredith DeFrancesco has more from San Salvador.
This week, over 60 international organizations will join a coalition of 40 Salvadoran organizations calling for an investigation of this month's assassination of social movement activist Hector Antonio Ventura Vasquez and the investigation of over 15 other assassinations being considered political in the past 2 years. The Salvadoran Archbishop's Human Rights Office and the Foundation of Study for the Application of Law, FESPAD, have found these killings fit international criteria, including the political profile of the victim, the pre-planning and character of the crime, and the lack of investigation on the part of the government. David Morales is a lawyer with FESPAD, one of the organizations who presented a petition to the Attorney General this month.
We believe it is important to do more than just denounce the assassination of political leaders, but also show that the Attorney General's office is tolerating the assassinations by not investigating the intellectual authors.
Morales says that authorities routinely attribute political murders to the gang crime prevalent in El Salvador, when in fact there is evidence that gangs are actually being used for political assassinations. One example is the 2006 assassination of local FMLN leader Eligio Ramirez in Cuscatlancingo.
So because of his community and social work, he had some contact with youth and gangs. And some of these youth told him that they had been asked by the Arena mayor leaving office to kill him. And these youth told him that they had said that they would not accept killing him, but that other people had accepted. So he was assassinated by two gang members, but the Attorney General didn't do any investigation into whether or not the mayor was related to the case.
Morales said this month two gang members were sentenced for the 2007 assassination of the journalist Salvador Sanchez, who actively followed the case of the Suchitoto 14, but the intellectual authors were not investigated. Last July, Hector Antonio Ventura Vasquez and 13 others were arrested prior to an anti-water privatization forum in a police attack condemned by human rights offices for its excessive use of force, backed by the military. The Suchitoto 14 were then charged with terrorism under El Salvador's controversial Decree 108, Special Law Against Acts of Terrorism. 2 weeks after all charges were dismissed, Ventura was brutally stabbed to death in a home where he was sleeping in a community outside Suchitoto. Lorena Martinez is the president of CRIPDES, the Association for the Development of El Salvador, a network of over 300 organized rural communities, and one of the Suchitoto 14.
Hector's murder, we could say, is a politically motivated murder. It has that characteristic since Hector was one of the 14 people detained and he was a young person who had a lot to offer and to develop from here onward. He was 19 years old. He was a young man who was committed to this process and had aspirations of changing things in his country. And that is why we believe it was a politically motivated murder.
In the last months, there have been reports of at least two more brutal murders of people connected to political opposition work from the communities surrounding Suchitoto, killings reminiscent of death squad killings during the war. These events are underlined by the official verification that paid assassin squads linked to the National Civilian Police have been recorded active in other parts of the country. Luis Herrera Fernandez works in the press office for the Attorney General.
It's been a long time in El Salvador since we have had murders with political motives. And if someone is saying it's happening, it's because it's a non-governmental organization that maybe needs money to maintain itself or to justify its income. All the cases are being investigated. Absolutely all. What happens is that when people don't hear what they want to hear, they say we're not working.
2 days before his assassination, Hector Antonio Ventura Vasquez had met with the mayor of Suchitoto and agreed to speak at the so-called Day Against Impunity to mark the one-year anniversary of the arrests of the Suchitoto 14 and their subsequent charges of terrorism. In January, Ventura, along with the other 14, spoke to a human rights delegation from the United States.
This law brings us together like brothers and sisters. You can see the laws in our country favor those who have money. And the people most affected by the law are those who struggle, those of us who are burnt by the sun, those of us who work. And if we protest, we are treated as criminals. If we demand our rights, we are treated as criminals and we are treated as terrorists, just like what happened to us. And so again, thank you for your solidarity.
There is a strong concern in the country that political violence will intensify leading up to the March 2009 presidential elections. Organizations in El Salvador say if the Attorney General continues to refuse to investigate the political connections to continuing assassinations, civil society will look to bring the issue to the Inter-American Court on Human Rights. With contribution from Norm Stockwell and Eva Schultz at WORT in Madison, this is Meredith DeFrancesco in San Salvador.
Podcasts and transcripts of Free Speech Radio News can be found online at www.fsrn.org. Their listeners can also comment on the day's stories and participate in discussion forums. That's online at fsrn.org. Being a journalist in Pakistan's tribal areas can be a difficult task. Reporters face threats on a regular basis from terrorist groups, as well as surveillance and obstruction by the military. In these tribal areas, reporters are not just victims of random violence, but are sometimes targeted outright. Until mid-May, 21 journalists had been killed in Pakistan since 1999. The most recent victim of anti-journalist violence is Mohammed Ibrahim, who was shot dead in the Bajwa region in late May. His death raised the number of dead to 22. FSRN correspondent Rahmanullah has more.
Journalists in Peshawar, Pakistan, chant slogans against the government, calling it killer. Reporters had taken to the streets to mourn the death of their fellow journalist Mohammed Ibrahim. The Union of Journalists claims that government secret agencies were behind his killing. The deceased reporter's son, Imran Khan, told FSRN how his father was killed.
My father told at home that he was going to interview Taliban spokesman Malvi Omar. He was very pleased that this was his first interview with his new camera. After conducting an interview, he was shot dead on his way home. We have no personal enemies. The killers have also taken his camera granted to him by Express News, a cell phone, 8 to 10,000 rupees, $160, and his motorbike.
Journalists have found that reporting often comes at a price. Where there were more than 30 journalists based in Waziristan in 2005, today they are so few that they can be counted on one's fingers. Dilawar Wazir covers tribal areas of Waziristan for BBC's World Service. 2 years ago, Wazir was kidnapped, tortured and released by gunmen who threatened to abduct him again if he publicly revealed their identities.
I've suffered many hardships. Once my home was destroyed by a bomb blast. I was also abducted and blindfolded. Journalism in tribal areas is a tough job and like playing with fire. Both militants and government cannot stand here and report critical of them, and both can make life miserable for you.
حکومت بندخانه ولا گدلو نه حکومت دتا د پاره باستونځه جوړاوی In another case, Hayatullah Khan, who reported from North Waziristan and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, was kidnapped by unidentified gunmen on December 5, 2005. His body was found in June 2006. He was kidnapped while he was on his way to report on a protest against a missile attack on a house in the village of Hasur in North Waziristan. Khan had taken photographs, a photo appeared to be pieces of a US missile at the scene of the attack. The pictures had provoked angry protests in Pakistan at the infringement of Pakistani territory by US forces. While both the authorities and local militant groups denied any involvement in his killing, allegations persisted that Pakistan intelligence agencies were involved. Last year, the widow of Hayatullah was killed by a bomb that was detonated outside her home. According to Ehsanullah, younger brother of the deceased Hayatullah,
intelligence agencies of Pakistan were giving threats to Ayatollah. In 2005, the top Al-Qaeda leader of Abu Hazm Arabia was killed in a missile attack in North Waziristan. Ayatollah made a detailed report and took photographs of the site. This was a U.S. attack on Pakistan soil. Pakistani intelligence agencies were unhappy with Ayatollah because of this report.
The Secretary General of the Khyber Union of Journalists in Peshawar, Khalid Keshgi, says all promises of the government regarding a probe into the murders of reporters in tribal areas have simply faded away.
Government should provide protection to reporters in tribal areas. The news organizations for which reporters are working should provide proper training and safety equipment to the journalists working in tribal areas. We also demand that the international community and international journalist associations put pressure on the Pakistani government to provide protection to the reporters working in tribal areas.
International watchdog group committed to protect journalists has identified Pakistan as one of the 13 countries with the worst records for solving murders of journalists. Pakistan's Federal Minister for Information, Sheri Rahman, says government will allocate a victims fund for journalists in the upcoming budget. A committee comprising senior journalists and government officials will supervise the fund and will help the journalists in tribal areas. She further says, Inter-Services Public Relations, ISPR, the press-related branch of the Pakistan Army, will arrange visits for reporters to the volatile tribal areas under strict security to minimize such incidents in future. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rahmanullah in Peshawar, Pakistan.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Monica Lopez and Kristen Schwartz. Headlines editor Shannon Young, DC editor Leanne Caldwell, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Oscar Hernandez, Eric Klein, Puck Lowe, and Rose Kitabchi. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.